and it's time now for sports. The World Series ended this week with the Giants bringing San Francisco their first championship. Free agency kicks off tomorrow, so let the games begin. Joined now by Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine. He's at member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Morning, Howard.
Good morning, Scott. The Giants won. The Red Sox have won. The White Sox have won. What about your Cubs and what about the Indians? They're the only two left.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that. And good morning to you, too, my friend. Yes,
starting off with a bang.
I wouldn't have realized that if not for your help. Listen, World Series got in the way of trick-or-treating this year and arguably campaigning in the midterm elections. Is Major League Baseball seriously interested in getting the season over before they start running into Santa's reindeer?
Well, supposedly they are. Changes are coming. Next year's World Series will end before Halloween. And there's a great deal of conversation about what to do and how to do that. The season is going to start next season a week early, March 31st. They're going to talk about more doubleheaders and getting rid of some off days and to try to condense the season without contracting the season. The owners are completely against cutting the season back to 154 games. So you've got to find some way to play more games with the same amount of days, actually.
Yeah. Well, the math didn't seem to work.
The math doesn't work because it's a weather sport. How are you going to play in March in Minnesota?
Yeah, exactly. March 31st. My gosh. Let me ask you before I mentioned that free agency is beginning. So Cliff Lee just gets sucked up to the New York Yankees? Is this what happens?
Well, you have to look at the number of teams that are going to be able to pay him the $20 to $25 million a year it's going to cost to keep him. The Texas Rangers say they're going to be competitive. The CEO, Chuck Greenberg, told me during the World Series, we're not going into negotiations with a pea shooter, but let's face it, the Yankees are one of the only teams that are going to be able to afford that type of money. They're going to be able to offer him 6 or 7 years at $20 to $25 million a year. There aren't a lot of teams that can offer that kind of cash.
Derek Jeter becomes a free agent, right?
Derek Jeter is a free agent, and Derek Jeter is in a very interesting position. He's a very interesting character right now because he is the face of the New York Yankees. He's the face of Major League Baseball right now, especially coming out of steroids. He's supposedly the clean guy, and adamantly the clean guy. He's also a 36-year-old shortstop, which you're not going to have that many on a championship team. And he's also 72 hits away from the golden 3,000 hit club. So someone's going to have to blink here. Derek supposedly wants a 5 to 6 year contract for a 36-year-old, and the Yankees aren't really willing to pay that. But how on earth can you imagine? Can anybody imagine Derek Jeter not being in a New York Yankees uniform next year?
I have to ask you, while we're talking about Derek Jeter and the NL East, we have, AL East, of course.
Ooh, boy.
We have Major League Baseball's winter meetings are just a few weeks away. Do you hear of any surprises lurking there?
Well, the big surprise is going to be the playoffs next season. There is a conversation, I wouldn't say proposals on the table right now, but conversation and ideas about adding another wild card team. Mm-hmm. And the wild card, we already have one wild card, but now there's talk about next season having one wild card team play a second wild card team in a one-game playoff. And the reason behind that is to stimulate competition in September between two teams that are in the same division that have already made the playoffs under the old system. And you're not that wild card team that goes the whole way and then has to play one more game to make the playoffs. It's to keep teams playing. I think actually what it really does is it virtually guarantees the Red Sox and the Yankees, the two biggest teams in baseball, to consistently always have a chance to be in the playoffs. It's a very controversial thing considering that under this system, if we did the system for next season, you'd have the Red Sox and Yankees playing a one-game playoff when one team was 6 games better than the other. And I'm not sure what that means for fairness, but believe me, things are moving in that direction for next season.
Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN.com and ESPN Magazine. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Yesterday brought some unexpectedly positive news on the job front. A report The U.S. Labor Department said 151,000 jobs were added to the economy in October. The unemployment rate, which some had projected to climb, held steady at 9.6%. NPR's Yuki Noguchi has more on what this means.
Heidi Shierholz is one of those economists who seldom, especially in the last 2 years, has had anything good to say. But here's what she said about Friday's employment numbers.
The employment report was good in the sense that not only did we have job growth, we had job growth that was actually more than what we need just to tread water. We need around 100,000 jobs every month just to hold steady, just to keep up with normal population growth. We got 151,000 jobs.
That was largely because businesses finally started hiring in large numbers. Workers were hired in mining, service, and healthcare-related jobs. Moreover, the report said September wasn't actually as bad as initially thought. Fewer jobs were lost than the department previously reported. But there is a darker side to this report. Again, Heidi Shierholz, the economist at the Economic Policy Institute.
The so-called underemployment rate moved a little, but it's essentially flat at around 17%. Bunch of these measures, they're just holding steady. And at this point, that's actually terrible news because they are holding steady at very, very high levels.
She says the recession left a hole about 11 million jobs deep. And even at last month's hiring levels, it would take a very, very long time to fill that gap. So then the question is, what will accelerate business hiring? Philip Condren has a simple answer: when there's demand. Condren runs an 8-person advertising company that's based in downtown Scranton, Pennsylvania. Condren and Company was among the first to react when clients cut back on their marketing budgets. He laid off one person and cut back another to part-time. 2 years later, they're at the same staffing level with no immediate plans to hire because of what their clients are telling them.
They're telling us that they're very cautious, that they don't want to budget for a year at this point. They want to budget quarterly. They're very cautious because they're not sure what next year's going to look like either.
Even if business were to increase, say in a year's time, he says he'll likely for some time rely on part-time or freelance workers.
Certainly not having to pay full benefits to someone is a benefit to us.
In the meantime, perhaps the biggest boon to Scranton in recent years hasn't been a political change or a federal program. It's been the success of the TV sitcom The Office, based on a fictional paper business roughly the size of Condren's, also based in Scranton.
It has made Scranton cool. People come, and every weekend there's a tour where you can go around and see all the various locations that are mentioned on the program. So, yeah, we have fun with it.
Fun that is also putting at least a few more people to work. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Now, one man who tried to stop the Wall Street shenanigans was Elliot Spitzer, feared and despised by some of the wealthiest men and women in America. But if his rise was dramatic, it didn't compare to his fall.
Today, I want to briefly address a private matter. I have acted in a way that violates my obligations to my family and that violates my or any sense of right and wrong.
Spitzer, of course, was a client of a high-priced prostitution service called the Emperor's Club. And when it was exposed, it ended his political career, a career that many expected to end at the White House. Now, the story of what happened is told in a new documentary. It's called Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer. It opens nationwide this week, and the director, Alex Gibney, joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Describe Elliot Spitzer at the height of his power.
At the height of his power, he was the sheriff of Wall Street. He was the one-man wrecking crew. He took the job of attorney general, which, you know, very often would go after crooked car dealers, and turned it into a kind of national phenomenon. Somebody who, from the attorney general's office, was trying to, in effect, legislate.
He went after folks on Wall Street who he thought were corrupt. Dick Grasso, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, who was paid $140 million, Elliot Spitzer said, too much, and he sued the New York Stock Exchange. He sued Ken Langone, who was on the board at the time. He went after Hank Greenberg, the head of AIG as well. He made enemies out of those guys.
Big enemies. To say they're angry at him, I mean, doesn't do the word angry justice. I mean, when they hear his name, you can almost see smoke come out of their ears. Ken Langone says in the film he remembers a pal of his coming out of a meeting with Spitzer, and he said he had the phrase EVIL emblazoned on his forehead.
Do you think he underestimated the power of his enemies?
I think he did. At the same time, he also knew their power. I mean, one of the odd things about doing this film was, you know, I spoke to Darren Dopp, who's his press secretary, while he was AG and also his governor. And he recalled a conversation that they both had in which they acknowledged that the enemies were not only angry, but very powerful. And if Elliot so much as sneezed wrong, they would come after him like nobody's business. Well, Elliot obviously didn't take his own advice.
Once the scandal broke and we all heard about Elliot Spitzer and this prostitution ring, we heard about a young woman named Ashley Dupree.
Everybody thinks that Ashley Dupree, as you say, was the one. In fact, she wasn't at all. She was a bit player in this drama.
She played up her role to further her career, right?
She did, and in a very clever way. I mean, she rarely said that she was more, but nobody in the media ever asked her. Now, she was important because she was in the federal affidavit, which is the list of charges. So there's a reason why she comes to the fore. But in terms of significance to Spitzer, she wasn't nearly as important as a woman that we'll call Angelina. And Angelina was a woman that Spitzer saw once, and they ended up having a kind of relationship. And
he met her all over the place.
Yes, and she became also very interesting to the federal investigators because there's a statute called the Mann Act. You're not supposed to take women across state lines for immoral purposes. Well, Angelina definitely went across state lines.
He met her in Puerto Rico.
Dallas, Palm Beach, Washington.
She has never spoken to the media. They tried to track her down. She left town. She left New York. How did you get her to agree to speak to you?
I actually managed to find out Angelina's real name. Then I managed to find out people we actually knew kind of in common. And I was, through that, able to arrange a face-to-face meeting. When I sat her down, I told her why I wanted to see her. And in that context, her cover, in effect, having been blown, she agreed to talk to me on one condition, that I not reveal who she was. And so with a filmmaker, you know, the old trope is you put the person in front of a light so that their face goes dark and you electronically modify their voice.
You didn't want to do that.
I didn't want to do that because I felt it would have been untrue to who she was. It would have been more false. I wanted to present her in a very human way. And so I transcribed two long audio taped interviews I did with her, and then I had an actress perform them.
And this actress in this scene describes the moment when she realizes it's Elliot Spitzer, the governor of New York.
He showed up with this baseball cap on, like clearly trying not to be recognized. I thought it was Elliot Spitzer, you know, but I couldn't be absolutely sure. So I made a point to look out for him in the papers.
Why do you think Elliot Spitzer did this?
He says, in effect, you know, if he had had an affair, he might still be governor, but he probably wouldn't be married. That he chose sex that was transactional, that wouldn't threaten the emotional bond that he had with his wife.
You say that there is a level of hypocrisy, that people like Bill Clinton get away with it, David Vitter gets away with it, but Spitzer wasn't allowed to get away with it.
I think part of the problem with Spitzer is that he had no friends, or he had very few friends. Bill Clinton had a lot of friends. Elliot Spitzer, his style was so combative. He had very few friends. But I think there was this element of hypocrisy with Spitzer. Elliot Spitzer was seen as highly hypocritical in part because he prosecuted escort services and sent people to jail, and yet he himself was going there. The issue of hypocrisy is one that seems to be very important to us as Americans. And I often wonder whether it's – I mean, is it really better to be consistently sleazy as opposed to inconsistently virtuous? I don't know. It's a question I keep asking myself.
Do you think there's a second act for Elliot Spitzer in politics?
I think because Elliot Spitzer is so smart and so good at understanding the political economy and so good at expressing it, that there will be a need for him. But he has one big problem, which is that he has to convince people to trust him again.
That's Alex Gibney. He's the director of the new film called Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer. Alex Gibney, thank you so much.
Great to be here.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Peg Conroy got her son to read books. She said that books could change their lives, be constant companions as they moved around from Marine base to Marine base, changing schools and friends. But in his reading life, Pat Conroy just acquired more and more constant friends: Milton, Tolkien, Churchill, Roth, and Dickey. Now Pat Conroy has written a memoir of the friends he made along the way through books. It's called My Reading Life. Pat Conroy, who's one of the best-read authors in America, author of The Prince of Tides, The Great Santini, and many other books, joins us from the studios of WKNO in Memphis. Pat, thanks so much for being with us.
It is an absolute pleasure.
So tell us about your mother and how she regarded reading.
What I remember about her from the very earliest time of my life is her reading to me before I went to bed. And she had a great tone, a warm style, a terrific Southern accent. And she read us lots of poetry. The Boy Stood on the Burning Deck, The Highwayman Came Riding, Riding, Riding. I can still hear her voice. She read Gone with the Wind, was the first novel she ever read to me. And her genius in reading that novel was being able to take players in that novel and compare them to people in our own life. Mm-hmm. Melanie Wilkes was my tacky Aunt Helen, who lived in Orlando. And she'd have Frank Kennedy as my Uncle Joe, who lived in Jacksonville. Naturally, she took on the role of Scarlett O'Hara, and that swashbuckling figure of a man was Rhett Butler, was my father, who was fighting in warplanes in Korea at that time. Mm-hmm. And she gave me, you know, I think my first clues that there was a relationship between life and art that was very close, and you just had to pay attention to find it.
I have to tell you, Pat, and I say this, being a Chicagoan like your father, to some of us, Gone with the Wind is about the death of a civilization that richly deserved to die.
Of course, it is, and it did. But here's what I like about it, Scott.
Yeah.
A girl from the place who lost outwrote all you Yankee boys and girls who wrote about the victors.
As long as we keep the victories literary, I guess that's all right.
You don't want it to be politically, and you don't want slavery.
Yeah.
And I was just surprised when I went back to read it how extraordinarily good it was.
Let me also get you to talk about, in this rich assortment of lives you present that you met through literature, somebody who sounds really as vital as your mother in making you the man and writer you are, and that's Gene Norris, your English teacher.
A fabulous man. He started teaching me when I was 15 years old. Mm-hmm. That summer, he took me up to Asheville, North Carolina, and he showed me Thomas Wolfe's house where he grew up in. And he took me to the house, and he said, there's where the boarders would eat at night. Thomas Wolfe's sister played the piano for the boarders and sang to them after dinner. He took me downstairs out in the backyard, and a guide said that Thomas Wolfe thought the apples in western North Carolina were the best in the world. So Gene jumped up, grabbed an apple, brought it down, and said, eat it, boy. I ate it, and it seemed almost like a moment of communion to me, almost a moment where I was given the keys to go out and try to write. And as a 15-year-old kid, I didn't know how to write, what to write, how to be a writer, how to go across it. I ended up going to the Citadel, which is not a great crucible for American writers. It ain't the Iowa Writers' School. And so I went through this, but I think it was my encounter with Gene Norris, my encounter with this extraordinary mother that drove me toward being a writer in the first place.
You know, Pat, it's inescapable that obviously, I mean, you've written a book about – you've written, I think, in a number of places, that, including this book, that when you were growing up, you thought your father might kill you and your family.
Mm-hmm.
And you were actually glad when he went off to war because it meant –
I used to pray for war against places like Vatican City. I didn't care where it was. But if we get him in the skies over some country that wasn't near me.
Yeah. And did you find a kind of refuge in reading?
There's no question. Dad would not hit you if he saw you reading. He thought you were studying. And it was the one time, you know, one place you could go to get away from his fists. And it worked every time.
You know, there's some people that skip over the dedications in books. I read yours. Can I get you to talk about it?
You certainly can.
You say this book is dedicated to my lost daughter, Susanna Ansley Conroy. Well, may I ask what the story is?
Yes. I got divorced from Susanna's mother. I think it happened in 1995 where it was final. And since that time, I've seen Susanna, I think, 3 weeks. And I think she was 10 years old when this all, you know, when it all began happening. But I've seen her 3 weeks. It's all court-ordered. But then California has an interesting law where there comes a time, it's pretty early, where the kid can say she does not want to see you at all. And Susanna evidently made that decision. And Scott, she has a perfect right not to see me. You know, she's 28 now.
Yeah.
But I thought this was going to be the last cry of the heart. I would at least try to get her attention and see if I could get her to come back. And it has been one of the most soul-killing things that's ever happened to me. And I'm delighted you mentioned it because I simply run out of ways to try to, you know, figure it out. I didn't want to, you know, when I go to her door, I don't want to knock the door down and do anything like that. But you know, it was a way, so I'm glad you noticed that and very happy you mentioned it.
Boy, and you sell millions of books all over the world.
Can't talk with my kid.
Well, Pat, this has been an extraordinary book, and I wish both you and your daughter, I don't know, peace. Pat Conroy, his new book, My Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Scott.
In Pat Conroy's memoir, But Reading, also explains why he writes, and you can read that excerpt at our website, npr.org.
In a few minutes, why the raving club kids in Europe are once again dancing to Barbra Streisand, or something like that.
Barbra Streisand.
But first, I know this program airs before dinner time for most of us, so forgive me for this next segment, because we're skipping right to dessert. And to do that, we headed to Safeway to meet up with our old friend and favorite top chef, Carla Hall.
So today we're going to make an apple cranberry frangipane tart.
That sounds fancy.
It sounds fancier than it is.
Is there an English word for it?
Apple cranberry almond tart.
Perfect.
Apple frangipane tart. That is what you can do right now with the mountains of apples you'll find in the supermarket. And this is the time of year, so Carla shows me how to pick the good ones.
That sounds good. Let's thump it like a watermelon.
Yeah. Let me thump one of those.
Okay, yeah, okay.
So armed with butter, flour, apples, more butter, sugar, eggs, butter, and some other stuff, we head back to Carla's kitchen.
So we've got, for our crust, it's basically a shortbread crust. So it's flour, butter, you know that, a little bit of sugar.
Right.
But in this crust, there's egg and a little bit of cream and vanilla.
Okay.
Okay. Then in the frangipane filling, we have almonds, butter, egg, and a little bit of flour, a little salt.
And some sugar.
And some sugar, yes, and some sugar. So that's the filling. And then we have the fruit. And it's basically sweetened apples. And we're going to cook those first. And then those are the three parts of the pie. So what I'm going to have you do is start cutting some apples.
Okay.
And I have a particular way that I like to do my apples. And, of course, you know I'll share that with you.
And Carla's method is pretty simple. Basically, you need to chop the apples into half-inch cubes. So she hands me the knife.
Because you like to chop and all that stuff.
I'm eating these apples as I'm cutting them.
That's what you have to do that. That's
so good.
That's like drinking the wine while you're cooking.
Yeah, while you're cooking, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this whole recipe is at npr.org, so don't worry if you missed anything so far. Anyway, as I chop the apples, Carla gets working on the crust, which is a little like shortbread. Flour, sugar, eggs, cream, butter, salt, all into the food processor, and you pulse until it makes a specific sound. You want to listen for a clumping, rattling noise.
You know why I love radio? Because this is the thing that I want to tell people. I said, use all of your senses to cook with and listen for it. Don't just use your eyes. And they have to listen for it here.
And you know it's ready.
You know it's ready. So what I'm going to have you do is get a pan on. You're going to saute those apples. Let's see, what do we have here?
Apples in.
Nice. If we hear something, we're cooking.
I sauté the apples in a pan with some oil and butter and sugar until they're crisp tender. Meantime, Carla gets working on the almond paste. Once again, everything into the food processor.
All right, so we are going to do 4 ounces or a cup of almonds. And honestly, I love almonds, so I'm being very generous. I feel like I'm like Paula Deen with the butter, but I'm doing almonds.
She adds some dried cranberries, ginger, egg whites, and sugar as well. And then she spoons a layer of the paste onto the bottom of the pie crust. She piles apples on top, and into the oven it goes for 20 minutes or so.
So let's take the tart out of the oven.
Ooh, that's nice.
And you can see how the apples have browned, and the frangipane is kind of puffy and getting brown, and the crust is really brown.
We gotta try it.
So let's dig in.
Okay. Mm. It's perfect. This is a perfect dessert. Oh, so good.
Mmm.
Thanks to Top Chef finalist Carla Hall for her apple cranberry frangipane tart. Next month, Carla returns to TV as a Top Chef All-Star. You can find her tart recipe and some photos at our website, npr.org.